Hello, you're very welcome to Burning Books. Joining me today is author Gráinne O'Brien, whose debut verse novel for young adults, Solo, is out now with Little Island. Normally, Gráinne, when I start the questions, I usually ask people what they were like as a child, as a reader, but I actually want to ask you, as a little girl, because I've just finished your book, Solo, and the main character is a musician, she's a musician at heart. Wait, did you start singing when you were tiny?
Yeah, so I did actually. So I had a kind of a strange childhood insofar as I was born and raised in 6 Mile Bridge, County Clare. But when I was five, my dad's job moved us to California. So my father, as far as my understanding of it was, is my dad is a businessman. He wore a suit and went to work. And sometimes he went away on business trips and then he came back. I never understood beyond that, really. So his job moved us to what was at the time the first kind of dot-com boom that was happening in Palo Alto in California in 1993. From what I can gather now, looking back on it, it was as if the company moved a bunch of people to different places. So we actually moved into the house of a family. And his family had been sent to Germany and they all worked for the same company. I'm not really sure how the dynamics of that worked. I was sent to a school in the local area and my parents had gone over to California on like a retcon mission, I guess, before my mother would agree to do it. And they had found this school in California and it had three Irish nuns working in it and an Irish librarian who we'll get to, Mary O'Shea. And it was there that I fell in love with reading and fell in love with singing. So they had a music program and I have photos of me standing in front of that whole school singing Spoonful of Sugar from Mary Poppins and dressed as Mary Poppins. It's funny the things that you remember in your life. When I was doing an event recently and Tomás Kenny gave me the microphone and said, "Do you know how to use a microphone?" And I said, "Like a lollipop." And he said, "Yes." And it was the custodian of that school handed me that microphone on that day and said, "You use it like a lollipop because you have to sing into a mic." You know, that was where my singing really came. Now, I am from a family of singers, like not professional singers, but like an O'Donnell, O'Brien sing along. Now, my cousin is a professional musician and all of my family on both sides are very musicals. But, you know. But I mean, I'm talking, you know, Catalonia at 4 in the morning in a shed in Mullingar or whatever.
Yeah,
so that's where it started. And that's where the reading started.
So you all started then as 5 or 6 years old. I'm just picturing you in a little Mary Poppins outfit with you.
Yeah.
That's a great song, actually, to start with. But
Yeah.
So what kind of books were you reading? So obviously a very different experience maybe to someone
very,
who was growing
very
up.
Very different. Yeah. Because they have their own classics and their own books. So, you know, things of like Under the Hawthorn Tree, Roald Dahl, Enid Blyton, that stuff I didn't start reading until I was a teenager. So Eloise was the one that I remember the most. And my aunt actually gave me a copy of it. She came to live with us when we were in California and stayed there. She's still there now. But we came home after 3 years, but she gave me a copy of Eloise and she used to read it to me. And Eloise, are you familiar with her?
No, I'm not. I was about to say, tell us about Eloise.
Eloise is great. Okay. It is not politically correct. I'm just going to go there now. Right. But she lives in the plaza. Her parents are nowhere to be seen. And she is raised by her nanny, who she calls Nanny. And there's like scenes in it and it's black and white illustrations. So Kate Thompson is the author. So she has like red lipstick. There's red. It's black, white and red. The illustration.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And there's scenes. When I say it's not politically correct, first of all, where are this child's parents? But also at the end of the night, Nanny is so stressed from looking after Eloise that Eloise pours her a gin and tonic. Like it's a picture book.
I don't know. There's got to be some merit in that. Yeah.
I know. And she's like, draws on the walls in the red lipstick. She's just a bowled girl. And okay. I was really into Ramona Quimby. I'm not sure if you knew Ramona. So Ramona was written by Beverly Cleary. And Ramona was, she was the same. She was ballsy. She didn't care. She did her own thing. She had a bob. I always had a bob. And Ramona Quimby. So they were the kind of American ones that I would have read a lot. And to be fair to my parents, they weren't obsessed with me reading Irish stuff when we were in America. They wanted me to read what my peers were reading, but Mary O'Shea. So she was the librarian there, and she was from, I can't remember what part of Ireland she was from, but like I can see her accent was so thick. And it was almost like, do you know the way sometimes you'd hear it? It was like it got stronger the more she was in America. And she cared very little if anyone noticed that she was fingering this like little Irish child that was wandering into the library. She didn't care. I always got a book, I always got a sweet, and she just really included me. And my memories of that school are very much around the library, and it was amazing. It's a thing that's not done in Irish schools to have a dedicated library and a dedicated librarian, and that was her full-time job, was to
That's I
just
wondered that that influenced you later on then in your choice of career.
100%. Like Mary O'Shea is, she's no longer with us, unfortunately, but I think of her. I want a woman in her 30s sitting on a podcast talking about me at some stage and like how I influenced their reading. It's not even through my writing, but through my bookselling and how like passionate that I share with them. That is all I've ever wanted from my bookselling career. I have to say, when I left O'Mahony's that week, of the customers coming in, and some of them I had worked with, like, as in there's a one particular family, and I gave their mother a book when she was expecting. And that little girl was 8 now, and they came in to me every Saturday, and like, Ruth, we were sobbing.
Oh my God.
It was really, and it was just, it was so. It was such a special time in my life, and I felt so valued by my customers and remembered by them. And it's all, yeah, it was all I ever wanted. And I never been particularly, I'm not really on social media much. I mean, people started to pay attention to the bookselling I was doing during lockdown because I had nothing else to do. So I was just doing weird things in the shop, on the Instagram page or whatever. But I understand the value of getting as many kids to read as possible, of course. But for me, it was always about those one-to-one connections and those customers that would come into me every Saturday with their pocket money or the parents that put absolute faith in me to recommend a book that their child would read and never tried to micromanage me while I
Brilliant,
did
yeah.
it. And Mary O'Shea drove all of that,
God, that's
100%.
amazing. And like, what about your parents at the time? I know you mentioned the father in Solo is a very important character. Well, so is the mother, but I just noticed that you dedicated Solo to your dad. Were either of them or both of them big influences on you
But
as a reader?
they both were. We just had books around the house all the time. I think if my father has any one failing when it comes to me, it's that he never got me to read Lord of the Rings. I tried, Lord knows I tried, but it just wasn't for me. I just found it too hard. It was too hard, and I just read everything. It didn't matter. But it was like I was reading Marion Keyes when I was 9 or 10. They were just there in the house, and I just read them, and they went over my head. I always laugh because I listen to you, obviously. But Forever,
Oh
everyone
yeah,
always
Judy
talks about
Blume.
Judy Blume Forever. For me, it was Flowers in the Attic. You know,
God,
do you remember we were
Oh
all
God,
passing it around?
Oh
Like,
yeah. It's an incre I mean, can you imagine?
when you think about it now,
I
like, but
know.
even I was talking to where so. Philip Pullman is bringing out his last book in September. He's gone back to the Northern Lights series, and friends of mine and I are rereading the first five, we'll say, in anticipation of the last one coming up. And we were talking about it yesterday. I was like, nobody would publish this for children now.
No.
And rightly, I would think it's not a children's book just because there's a child in it. And now Philip Pullman is quite open about this as well. He's like, I just write books and the market decides what it wants to do with them.
Yeah.
But it's just, you're just looking at stuff and you think, God, bad. But yeah, books were always there. I remember one time I went to my grandparents' house in Mullingar, and they had like books around the house, but they would have been, you know, kind of more like Yeats and traditional kind of classics. But obviously, someone at some point had visited my grandparents and left behind a copy of Jaws. And I read it, and it is, I mean, it's one of the greatest novels ever written. But when I tell you, like, I was afraid of sharks in pools for years as a result of reading Jaws. When I was, because if you think the film is bad, you should read the book.
Yeah, I've never read the book. I know the
Oh,
film is,
it's
I think I
so
saw the
good.
film
It's
as 11 years old.
terrifying.
Absolutely terrifying. Yeah.
Terrifying, you
Oh,
know?
brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's like a great, like the idea that I would be in my grandmother's house and have nothing to read. I just picked up Jaws. I was like, well, I obviously have to read this big scary shark book. Obviously, I can't possibly not read something.
You still get a little shiver when you go into the sea, do you know
Little
that?
bit, just a smidge, yeah. Ooh.
Going to ask you about rereading in a minute because I always find that really interesting why people do that. But on the time scale here, because I know, like, so you're in California, your dad was the businessman as far as you're aware as a child. Who knows what that job
Absolutely.
is? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And whatever. And then, but then, and so, because I know that you studied at University of Limerick, but did you come back to Ireland before then, or was that the point
Yeah,
where you came
no. So we
back?
came back to Ireland. I went into fourth class when we came back,
Okay.
and then had kind of a rocky transition home because so I went back to the school that I had started in, and it was quite small. There were six kids in my class,
Oh my goodness.
and those six kids had been together since junior infants and had
So,
known me in senior infants. But then I came back, and it just didn't fit, and it was kind of halfway through the school year. It was later in the school year. I don't remember the exact details of it. I do remember that my father came home first, and my because the job wanted him to come home, and my mother stayed in America on her own with the three of us for a while so that we could finish school, the school year. It was that time that I became really close to my aunt, and her and I still have a great relationship. She I'm godmother to her daughter. She rang me the other day, and she was like, we were chatting about Solo, and she said, you know what you should do is write a series. And I was, all right, okay, I'll get on that.
Just give me a second.
Just give me a sec. That commercial. Oh, she was like, they do really well commercially. I was like, yeah, I know. I'm aware of the series viability. I
Have you
was
ever
like, no.
thought? Yeah, 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 yeah.
So then my parents decided that it just wasn't working. So they moved me into a much bigger primary school in Cratloe National School.
Okay.
And there was like 20 kids in the class. And sure, another kid turning up, you know, with a slightly American accent was not anything to be blinked at. So I stayed there for fifth and sixth class, and then I went to secondary school in Limerick. So I went to Villiers, which is a private school, but it has a really good music program.
Okay, so is this
Yeah.
and is it and so you studied music for
So I would have been probably an intense, sensitive kid. You know, I've become an intense, sensitive adult. So I don't have any problem in telling you that my parents sent me to Villiers because it was quite a protected environment, and I would say they were concerned about what I was going to be like when I hit the secondary school system. I did study music. I did voice training while I was there, but I was never going to be like a massive soloist. You know, I just plodded along, and I did my exams a little bit, but I just took a lot of joy in it.
Yeah.
You know, and then, as so often happens, became resentful of it as I became a teenager and resisted it a lot. And then I sang in St. Mary's Cathedral Choir here in Limerick, which is a really good choir. Like the level is quite high,
Okay.
and I sang with them for a year, and I loved it. But it's one of those things, like the rehearsals are Friday night, the
Right.
service is Sunday morning. Gráinne went to college. She wasn't particularly interested in getting off on Sunday morning or being in a church singing on Friday night. So I was never Daisy. I mean, she's was never Daisy level. It was just something that I enjoyed doing.
Did the same thing happen with reading as happened with practice? Because a lot of people sort of move away from reading and then move back to it. You know, they gravitate towards it again when they're a bit older. There's those sort of weird, funny years. Did that
Yeah.
happen to you, or did you go deeper into it?
No, I went deeper into it, particularly when my father got sick, which would have been kind of when the rereading really took off for me. I couldn't not read, but I couldn't focus on anything new. So I
Okay.
would say for 2 years, I reread and read and reread. When I went to college, I probably became a little bit more because I was studying English. I didn't read maybe as much as I could have.
Sure.
But I don't ever remember. I would say I kind of struggled with reading. I suppose most people did during lockdown, but I've never not
Okay, you've
read.
never had that sort of
No,
break or slump.
I don't think so.
I'm really interested in this because I don't, what do you get out of rereading, or why do you go there? Like, what is it about going back to the, and what texts do you go back to? What books do you go back to?
So, for me, it's the comfort of knowing how it's going to end.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know sacrilegious, I know, but I would be kind of a last page. I just throw an eye at the last
My
page
goodness.
sometimes.
No, Grania.
I know.
You mean for
They are
books that you
rough
haven't read yet, like new
sometimes.
books, you still
Oh,
glance
Ruth,
at
I
the
don't
end.
know
Oh
how
my
it's going to
goodness.
go. I get really stressed out.
Oh my
I know, it's
God.
shocking. It's shocking.
Yeah,
I know.
you know you're probably not alone. I doubt you're alone in that. Okay, so you really need the sense
I need
of
the sense of
certainty.
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So for me, it's how it's going to end, and the Tamara Pierce, Alana and the Lioness series. My dad bought me the first one, and I actually remember standing at the customer service counter of O'Mahony's and having my chin on the counter like this, and my mother
Oh.
ordering the rest of them for me. And Dawn, who's been there like 25 years, she's like, "It was me." I was like, "Okay, well, let's." Maybe it wasn't. She was like, "No, it was
My
definitely me."
God. So
Yeah.
you can remember having your chin on the counter, the same counter that years later you'd be sat
Yeah, I
behind. Oh
remember
my
it because
God.
O'Mahony's is iconic in Limerick. Nobody else gets
Yeah.
any, nobody goes anywhere else to get their books, you know, really. I vividly remember it. And it was the Song of the Lioness. And I remember, let's say it was Dawn, but I don't think it was. Whoever it was said, "One is reprinting, but I can get the other two." And my mother turned to me and said, "Do you want the other two while you wait for the third?" And I said, "Yes." And the one that was reprinting was the third one. So I read the second one and I read the fourth one. And then I read the third one when it came in. I remember it so vividly. And then I reread them all the time. And Alana is the first female character. She's the first female character that I ever, first of all, she gets her period. She has men in her life that are good to her. She's never assaulted. She is strong. She knows what she wants. And she never wavers in that. She's also not a particularly, she has layers and vulnerability. And Tamara Pierce has done that with all her books really, really well. Like she has written 16 books in this Tortall world. She's done others, but they're all strong female characters that are just kind of forging themselves in this. And it was also my first kind of foray into fantasy. I don't read many of like the big, my husband is obsessed with fantasy books. Like he, those huge epic Brandon Sanderson. Like if the book isn't this size, he is not
Yeah.
interested. I never got into those, but I appreciate the genre for what it does, and I love it. And she, so I would reread those if not once a year. I would be surprised. Certainly
Okay.
one of them, you know.
And you kind of you kind of go, you gravitate towards rereading then when you're maybe life is in a bit of chaos or you feel that you
Yeah,
just want grounded in some way, just go back
absolutely.
there.
Like I just need some familiar stuff. Like, you know, during lockdowns, I was reading, I read all the Agatha Christies again, and I was like, Poirot's here, everything's
Yeah.
fine. It's all going to be okay. Or, you know, my, like, I'm alone a lot because my husband is in the defense forces. So when he goes away, that first month can be a little unstabilizing. So I just need to kind of get grounded and like learn to take care of myself. He is the domestic in the house. so I would kind of reread at that then as well. You know, I just kind of, and I kind of plan when I know he's leaving, I'm like, okay, I'm going to read. Going to
Have
read.
them lined up.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm reading Shadow of the Wind this week. And then I'm, yeah.
So tell me, like, at what point did you? I know we've said like you had the chin on the counter, but you couldn't have
Yeah.
possibly known then. So like that you were going to be a bookseller. And did you do like so after college, after University of Limerick, did you go traveling? Did you do your master's? Did you go straight into bookselling, or like what? Like where
No,
were
so
you?
I went back to California. I blame my mother for the reason why I decided I wanted to be a writer. I wasn't a kid that wrote at all. Like, I didn't have diaries. I didn't write. I didn't have an ambition to write. You know, you hear about those people who wrote their whole lives. It wasn't me. I was reading, you know, the
Yeah.
reader. My brothers are both very successful. One's an engineer, one's an actuary. So they're really like high, you know, achievers of these kind of really mathematical jobs.
Okay.
And my father was an engineer. It turned out businessman. He was an
That's what it
engineer.
was.
Yeah. Yeah. My mother was a nurse, which was easier for me to understand.
Yes.
So I was this kind of creative anomaly kind of in the house, I think. And I remember my mother and I were sitting in a restaurant waiting for people to come and join us. And I was obviously having some kind of existential dread. I think I was 19, 18 or 19 or 20. And I was like, oh, sure. We were talking about my brothers. And I said, oh, sure. I don't know what I'm going to be. And my mother said, you're going to be the next Marion Keyes. And I was like, what? She was like, yeah, chance would be a fine thing. But she said it with such certainty that, and I don't even know if she even remembers that story. But for me, it was like, obviously my parents had decided this was the obvious way that my life was going to go. Whether or not it was writing, it was certainly books, you know, I
Yeah.
think is what the message kind of was at the time. And then I started writing a little bit. I had a bit of a knock, a confidence knock with like one of those kind of, you know, those creative writing workshops, and you get kind of a maybe an overenthusiastic teacher who, for whatever baggage they're bringing to the scenario, decides to make shit of everyone's work. But I was only 21 or 22 when that happened, and I took it really personally. And I,
Yeah.
like, looking back on it now, I don't even think the feedback was that bad, but I was so, like,
Yeah, you're
you
so
know,
tender. You're so
so
tender at that
tender,
stage.
so
Yeah.
tender. And at that stage, like, I had come through, I had dragged myself through a leaving cert. Like, you know, my father had been sick for fifth and sixth year. I had just, when I say I scraped into college, it was pretty, you know, those horrible 3 days. I don't know if it's still the case, but like there's three
Yeah.
days where you got your results, but you didn't know if you got your course.
God.
Those 3 days, it was like someone had died in the house. Like, what was going to happen? Was I going to repeat? I was so resistant to it because the expectation of me had been, I was an okay student, but I think that I was very good at giving off the impression that I was studying, but I
Hear
wasn't focusing on anything, or, you know, I wasn't absorbing anything or taking anything in. And then, like, I'll never forget it. It was so the points dropped by 10 points, and I
Oh,
got into the
good.
course, and I had gotten Irish grinds from my neighbor, and she checked the points on Teletext and called my house at 9 o'clock in the morning, and she's like, you got your points. I said, yeah. Teletext.
Gosh, yeah,
Yeah,
that's
375 points is what it took to get into UL doing history at the time. And that's how many points I got in my leaving
brilliant. Back of the
cert, you know?
net.
Anyway, so that was it. And they, so I did a master's in sociology. It was kind of that crash period, like who was getting a job? What were we doing? And my aunt rang me and she said, why don't you come move to California, work for tech? That's what she was doing. That's what she's still doing.
Okay.
She worked for tech startups. And for some reason, my creative soul thought that that was where
Oh
I
my
was going to
goodness.
thrive. Yeah. And my parents,
Oh.
my father in particular, was really upset that I was not writing, that I was my father calls me all the time, and his first question is also, to my frustration sometimes, is, are you writing? I'm like, I just published a book. Can you give
Oh,
me a
yeah.
break?
But isn't that fantastic to have that
Yeah,
kind of
absolutely.
support,
Not
though?
very few writers get this.
It's reminding me of the father in Solo, and like, because I was reading it and I was like, yes, you're right, I'm going to make this my mantra as well. And he was like, you've got to want it, you've got to really want it, and you've
Yeah.
got to want it more, and practice, 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 put in the work, but you want it.
Yeah.
That's such great advice,
Yeah. And
in
if you
many
don't
ways.
want it, that was my big thing with Daisy, was I wanted her to want it.
Yes.
I didn't want the reader to think her parents were pressuring her.
Yes, that they wanted. Yeah, I get you. Yeah.
She had to want it. And that was very much like they were like, you have to want it, you know? And I didn't at the time. And
Yeah.
yeah, and I went to California. I was the only woman in an office of 13 men. I called them men, they were boys, you
Yeah.
know? And I just ran their operations. Like I just took care of, you know, I like it's so gendered, but I did the female office role in a, you know, in that office. But it
With
was
the
a
tech
great,
bros,
yeah,
basically.
pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was a great experience for me in a lot of ways because it taught me what I didn't want. I applied for another visa. The application got denied. And I just said, I'm going home.
That's it.
Yeah,
You
I'm
know.
going home. And I was 26, I think, 26, 27. And I moved home to my parents' house, and I had had a job in Omani's on the school books counter like a couple of years earlier. It was November, and I was sitting watching TV. I was watching like it was either Maury or Jeremy Kyle or something shocking that was on at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the house phone was ringing, and I wasn't answering it because it was my parents' house phone, and I got a text from one of the girls I used to work with in Omani's. And she said, Colette Cotter is trying to call you. And she was the shop manager of Mahoney's, of the main
Okay.
shop. So I called her back and she said, oh, I heard you're back from America. I said, yeah. And she said, I need someone who knows how to use the till for Christmas for 2 weeks. And I was there 10 years later.
So it began.
So it
Yeah.
began.
And what was that like for you then being back? Because that's a funny age to come home,
It was
27, isn't it? Like,
awful. Yeah, it
yeah.
was awful. It was really bad. It was the hardest time of my life, to kind of because I had to not only deal with the fact that I had kind of come home with my tail between my legs, but also I had to kind of confront why I had left as
Yeah.
well, because I was always running away from something, I think, and to kind of, you know, and just kind of really kind of ground myself again
Yeah.
and just figure out like who am I and what am
What do I
I,
do? What am I for?
what am
Yeah.
I for, you know? And I was really resistant to it, and I was, you know, I didn't commit myself to working in O'Mahony's for a while, and there came a time, it might have been either even 2 years later, where I just thought, you know, if I'm going to be here, I really need to be here, and I need to commit to it, and
Yeah.
like just accept that whatever I thought, because I did try to go, but I tried to get like a tech job in Ireland for a while.
Oh.
It just didn't work out. And it was just like, if you really throw yourself into this, you can be brilliant at it, you know, but
Yeah.
you have to want
You have to
it.
want it. You have to
Yeah.
really want it. And
Yeah.
was there a book that kind of that you were reading at the time or anything that you kind of held on to at that sort of in that weird liminal kind of in between e space.
Well, Notes from a Coma by Mike McCormack has always been, because I read it in college as part of a sci-fi module, and it's always been a real anchor to me because I think when I read Notes from a Coma, everyone talks about Solar Bones, and they're right too. But long before Solar Bones, Mike wrote Notes from a Coma, and I read it as you do, as you read stuff for college, you know, I kind of
Yes,
read it
yeah.
and I assessed it and I reassessed it and blah, blah, blah. And I studied it. And then I reread it at this stage of my life. And I thought, I am going to write something like this. Because have you ever read Notes from a Coma?
I haven't. I'm
Yeah.
just shaking my head here when you're saying that I
Like,
love it when that happens, when you
yeah.
read something and it just gives you that fire and you're
Yeah.
like, this is what it's about.
Yeah. And Notes from a Coma. When you read it, okay, so here's how I'm going to teach you how to read Notes from a Coma to save you,
Yes.
right? So it's written in two parts. It's written in, so what's happening to the character is happening on the top, okay? And what's happening to the bottom, what's happening, so it's a kind of a future Ireland where there's a prison overcrowding. So there's a prison overcrowding. And in order to deal with that, they have proposed putting
Oh,
prisoners in a coma
brilliant.
instead of giving them a life sentence. And they ask members of the public to volunteer for it.
Oh, I love it.
So, yeah, so the top part is the character of JJ, and it's explaining why he has particular, has what has happened in his life that has led him to this point. And then the bottom in the footnotes, it's telling you about the project. Okay. And if you
Excellent.
try to read them together, you can't. It gets confusing. This is my, I've reread
Yes.
Nostracoma plenty of times, so you don't
This
have
is, no, I
to.
want to. This is going top of my
Yeah.
list because Solar Bones is one
So
of my
you read
all-time
the
favorites.
top part, and then you read the bottom part, and then you read the top part again.
Oh, yeah.
That's how I read it every time. When you're reading it, you are going to think, this is so simple. But it took, I think I heard on the grapevine, it took 7 years to write. I don't know if that's true, but I would absolutely believe it, you know. And I met, so when I, so yeah, so Nostracoma, and I just adore it. And my first, when I moved to Kenny's, which was a big jolt, obviously, we've already talked about the sobbing customers that I would leave at Annie's. But the first event that I worked was Display of Souls, which was coming out.
Come on.
Yeah, and I was like, oh my God, Michael Cormack's gonna be here, like Michael Cormack, yes, oh my God. And then Tomás Kenny was like, well, make sure you meet him. I was like, no, I don't want to meet him. What if he's there? So like, I don't want to know. He's not, by the way. Just as a caveat. And I was like, I'm too nervous. I can't talk to him. Like, I can't look at him. I don't want to meet him. And then I was completely confused because it was a brand new till system. But I sure I was completely
Oh,
over my head that
gosh.
day. And Tomás said, just before the event started, he said, have you met Mike? I said no, Tomás, I really, please, just I don't want to. And he said, so he brought me over to him, and he was like, this is Gráinne O'Brien, she's one of your biggest fans, and she's one of our new staff members. And Mike just looked at me, he said, hi, nice to meet you. And I gave him my book, and we were kind of standing in silence as he signed it. And I just said, I just the reason why Tomás said that, he's like, Notes from Coma is my favorite book. And he looked at me and he went, that was a long time ago. And he was like, thank you. I was like, you're
Yeah,
so cool.
it's just, but what do you say? I know that feeling as well, where you just find yourself just saying the most inane things as well.
Yeah. And I do
That's it.
think that, but I do think that authors really appreciate when you talk to them
Absolutely.
about the books that they're not the most known for, you
Yeah.
know.
Because you're right about Solar Bones. And I was thinking, it's like, I'd go on about Solar Bones to people. And I haven't
Yeah.
read Notes
Notes
from,
from
I'm going to
Coma.
rectify
Oh,
that. Yeah,
I
for
had it
sure.
recently. This is so name droppy, but I met Marion Keyes as well, like recently
Oh,
for
there you go.
because she was doing a literary event, and we were talking about the Walshes, and I said, "Can I just tell you, like, Mercy or The Mystery of Mercy Close is my favorite, and Helen is my favorite," and she was like, "Thank you so much for saying that because nobody ever says
There you
that."
go.
I was like, "I love, but Helen, Walshy woman, like she's the, you know, Helen's my." Ramona, Eloise, there's a pattern here, Ruth, you
This is true. This is true. Do you know what? I want to bring you back because you mentioned earlier, you were chatting earlier about this, and we're not going to name any names, but somebody who kind of crushed you a little bit when
Oh,
you first started. I think that's really stuck with me, actually, because you don't realize what one line of criticism could maybe do to someone who's just beginning. And we get hardened as writers. We get, well, certainly personally speaking, you get so hardened and so sort of, I don't know, you get used to it, or you get used to rejection, or you just become so kind of, your skin does get a bit thicker as far as criticism goes, I think. Maybe,
Absolutely. Yeah.
or we pretend
Well,
it does.
I do think, I worry that if I encourage people to toughen their skins a little bit, that you do run the risk of losing their empathy, which I do think is really important. But I do think it gets to the stage where it just doesn't, you kind of learn what's valuable and what isn't. You know, like I know now that that audience was not the audience for what I was writing.
And you said that you've read lots of like books on craft, and I know people like people go to all these workshops and they follow this kind of thing. Because I want to, because a lot of people don't choose books that they're going to leave in the house. And I think this is really interesting because I tend to really agree with you. And it's like there with a couple of exceptions of books that maybe are just beautiful to read in themselves for themselves about the craft of writing, which is a different thing. But yeah, tell me how you feel then about these, how to write
So I think that the turning
books.
point for me with regards to writing really came when I decided to do the MA in creative writing in UL, which was 2018. So it was my husband, God bless the poor man, he was in the infantry. So he had been an infantry soldier for since he was 17, joined the army straight out of college, out of school, and he'd never been to college. And he decided that he wanted to go to college, and the army will send you to college if it benefits the army. So if you want to change into a different, so for TJ, it was he wanted to change into signals, which is the kind of IT communication side of of it.
Okay.
And he went through all these really intense tests and studying and courses, and for someone who had never been to college, now I went to college professionally at that stage, I was really inspired by him and jealous of him, and we talk about this a lot because the night he was going back to college or starting college, I got really upset because I was so proud of him, but I was so jealous that he had found a purpose and I was still in that kind of young, I was still, happy book selling, but I was like, I just, it's just not what I'm supposed to be doing for my fulfillment, I guess. And he said, maybe you should look into a writing course. And I googled it. So much of my life is just happenstance and luck. I googled it, and the deadline for the Creative Writing Masters in UL was the next day.
Oh, come on. Seriously?
It was the next day, and I threw in, when I say I threw in the application, I had a few bits that I had already written, and I was so lucky. And another bit of luck for me was that Joseph O'Connor, who was running the course, was about to take sabbatical. He was going to take some time off to write Shadow Play. And he had brought in Sarah Moore Fitzgerald, who worked in UL, who was a writer, but who wasn't on the academic, she wasn't teaching on the creative writing school yet. And she and I knew each other from our writing group. And he mentioned, so I hadn't told her, I hadn't told anyone. Sure, I didn't have a chance to tell anyone. It was the night before that I had applied. He called me the week later and said, he called my mobile, and he said, my name is Joseph O'Connor. I want to offer you a place on our creative writing masters. And I said, did you not want to meet me or anything first? Because I knew other people who did it. I knew that Joe meets people, beforehand. And he said, Sarah Moore Fitzgerald speaks very highly of you, so we're happy to give you a place. And I called her and she was like, why did you not tell me? I said, I did. I just didn't. And I called my parents, I called my father, and it was like, what do we have to do to make this happen? What do you need? Do you need money? Do you need,
Oh,
like,
it's
what
brilliant.
do you need to make this happen? And Colette Cotter, who was my manager in Emani's, who has mentored me for 10 years, was the same. She was like, what do we need to do for you to
Oh my
make this
God.
happen for you? And it was, yeah, it was an amazing, and it changed my life. Like, it changed the course of my life. It is the reason why I ended up writing a Limerick Fairy Tale. It's the reason why Solo was published. Like, those connections, those friendships, and really, like, that is where I learned feedback. You need to know where to take feedback from,
What to listen to,
because
what to take and let go.
Because you're sitting in a group with 12 other people, all of whom have, some are poets, some are fantasy writers, some are kids writers, some are whatever. Like, and then you take, and then you're like bombarded with all this feedback. And then you go home and you take it all apart and you're like, okay, well, what is actually applicable here and what can I ignore,
What can I ignore? Yeah, it's like that old adage, how do you make a poor decision? Listen to everybody.
Exactly. But so anyway, so the craft, the writing craft. So when you sign up for the MA, the first book they get you to write is On Writing by Stephen King.
Yeah, I was going to mention that actually.
And then Sarah Moore Fitzgerald is a big fan of Release the Bats. And I read them, and I've read them all. Like, I have loads of them. But the reason why I would let them burn is because I went through a phase of my life where I took everything that was in those books as like something I should try to apply. And if I failed, like, Stephen King recommends you write 1500 words a day no matter
I
what.
mean, that, yeah.
And I, like, you're setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah.
You really are. And it's the times when I really bullied myself is when I tried to apply someone else's writing process to
Yeah.
my own work. Whereas now I've kind of learned about myself anyway, and just how I work, is that every book is different. How I wrote A Limerick Fairy Tale is different to how I wrote Solo, to how I'm writing an adult novel. I've been writing an adult novel for years, and I just kind of tip away at it, and then I've got other stuff. It's just all so different, and I try to, like, make a deal with myself that I do something that I know I'll be able to do. So for Solo, I kind of realistically was like, I know it sounds so ridiculous, but I was like, I can give 5 minutes a day to this book, right? And obviously, more often than not, it was more than five. But if I did my 5 minutes, I was free then to not let it cause a stress in my life. Some of those poems were written in 5 minutes. Like there's one called Minim.
Oh yes.
I
Hit and
wrote.
oh that's beautiful.
And I thought about it for 3 days, and then I had 5 minutes, and I set the timer, and it just came out. And I don't think it would have come out if I had, it just because I had
And
to get
that's
it
it's
done.
so it's like a beautiful, and just for our listeners who haven't maybe read it, that's a beautiful, it's a love scene, it's a
Yeah,
sensual scene, it's an
in two
erotic
words.
scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Minim, I loved the musical references through this. I mean, I wouldn't call myself a musician. I play piano and guitar and bits like that. But for me, this
Okay, I'm
it
going to stop
really.
you right there, Ruth, because I talk about myself that way. If you play piano and guitar and bits like that, you are a
Don't
musician.
you know what I mean?
You
Not a
know,
proper musician.
and again,
Yeah.
I would go around to my friends who are like my choir director, and I'd say, I need a proper musician to read this. And
Yes.
she'd be like, okay, well, I'm going to stop you right there. You are a proper musician. You've been
Yeah.
singing in choirs for 20 years.
Gosh. But that's so what brought you to, well, you see, it seems a stupid question now because it's kind of obvious why this is a verse novel when you think about what the book is about. Like
Yeah,
it's yeah.
I don't know if you've ever tried to get a teenage girl to do anything.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, fictional teenage girls are just as tricky. And I forced that book into prose for a really long time. And Daisy was like, no,
Not having it.
not having it. So the first poem written in it is polyphonic, which comes much later in the book, but it's like this idea that all of these voices are talking. And I was like, I was like, that's really cool. I'm gonna call that one polyphonic, and I'm gonna make it look like all the voices are talking at once. I'm gonna cram all the words together, and I'm gonna do that.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I could actually do that for the whole book,
Yeah.
just because the musicians, the composers that came before us were such geniuses and poets in how they like you can put like a word on a manuscript, and the musician knows exactly what that all
Yeah.
what that composer wanted.
Yeah, there was a beautiful one. What was it, the word with it just was like with bitterness. And I was like, wow, I haven't even come across that before.
Well, I have to say, I became very good friends with the Oxford Dictionary of Musical
Musical too,
Terms.
yeah. Some of them, yeah.
And some of them, sometimes flipping through that book gave me the idea, and some of them, the like crescendo, diminuendo, those kind of
Yes.
ones kind of wrote themselves.
Yes.
And then my choir director, Cecilia Madden, who is she is a creative genius. And I've always known it about her, but I really appreciate her so much more now that I've gone through this process of like studying what these classical musicians go through and the lives that they live, and how she read it and said, I understand what you're doing here, but I think this one would be better. And she made some suggestions of like how it would go. I'm kind of smirking now, but I
Yeah.
will tell you the story. It's kind of funny. So we were, because I do want to say, like, I don't generally use these words in public, and I did tell the story at an event recently, but she, there's another poem just for the reader. There's not a wild amount of sensuality. It's teenagers, but there's one called Handwork, and she said, and I still have it, and it's gone in the archive. I printed her a copy, and she's written on the side of it. The correct term for this is fingering. And I text her a picture of it, and she was like, yeah, well, it's true. And I said, I don't. And then I put in an email to Siobhan Parkinson, former Laureate in an Óg, my editor, and one of my editors, Orla Carr, was my other editor. She had just started in Little Island. Just a quick thing. And so Siobhan, I mentioned it at an event. Siobhan was on the panel, and she was like, yeah, you wrote around that for a really long time. I was like, just okay. And a choir director said that the right term on this is, and
Just
then
keep it.
or like Siobhan didn't reply, and then Orla very diplomatically was like, I think that it has the potential of making it a bit tacky, so we're gonna leave it the way it is. I said,
Yeah,
perfect. So I text Cecilia and I said, so my editors decided we're gonna leave it Handwork, and she went, okay, it's not correct though.
there's so many terms that I don't know. Oh, well, an obbligato was a nice one. But yeah, so the recorder is Daisy's instrument.
Yes.
And I know because you were a singer and we've talked about you being in a choir and that's a very that's a really stupid thing to say. That's a very communal experience. But
No,
you're
100%.
it is,
Yeah,
but you're
absolutely.
in a
Yeah,
choir. It's very
you're
different
one
to
of
be
many.
you're on the you're yeah. But Daisy is, yeah, she, do you say recorderist?
She's a recorder player.
Is that what you say?
Yeah,
Okay, I
she's a
was
recorder
wondering. She's a
player.
recorder player. So,
No. The recorder doesn't even get a special name.
no,
You're
yeah,
just a
you're
recorder
just the
player.
player.
You're not a cellist or a violinist, you're just
No.
a recorder player.
Oh, you've just
I might
reminded me
be
of some.
wrong. Like I might be wrong. I'm sure there may be a term, but my understanding of it was that you're a recorder player.
You're a recorder player.
Yeah.
You've just reminded me of something. There's all these different musical fa about composers in it. And it was who punched a bassoonist? Did
Oh, that was
someone
Bach.
punch? Oh, it was Bach.
Yeah, Bach,
Okay.
he punched a bassoonist. Yeah.
Did not know that. Just because
Yeah,
he
Bach.
hated the bassoon or because.
Bach, no, the bassoonist said something to him. Like Bach, so Bach runs through it. So it's the 78 cantata was the so when you study Leaving Cert Music, the Bach, they change it every 3 years to give the music teachers a break. But the year that I did it, the Bach 78 cantata, you study Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet, you study Gerard Barry's piece, I can't remember its name, and you study Bohemian Rhapsody. So those are the
Okay.
four main core pieces that you study. And the 78 is so the original structure for solo was so the 78 I hated studying my Leaving Cert because again I was a teenage girl, like what are you talking to me about? But my choir sings it every year as a performance for the Leaving Cert students now in Limerick.
Okay. Yeah.
So I've learned to love it through my choir experience. So I wanted this originally the format for solo was going to be broken up like the cantata
Yeah, I was
is.
wondering about the.
Yeah, so I had like the idea that I would have there's like duet and I would only have two characters speaking to each other. This was during when it was still a prose book and like it was all this kind of stuff and I kind of slipped away from that, but I really did want the 78 to have its moment. And I wanted Leaving Cert students to recognize it, but also so and I like Flora, the idea of having a character that's obsessed with composers in the way that like I would have been obsessed with like Robbie Williams,
Yeah.
you know, I really liked. And I chose the recorder. Originally she was a viola player. Daisy was a viola player, but because I wanted it to be an instrument. I always thought the viola had kind of an inferiority complex about the violin. I don't know why I've given it that baggage, but I liked the idea of her picking an instrument that was kind of an outlier or that she viewed as an outlier. But in the interest of full transparency, I don't know how a viola works. And I watched a lot of YouTube videos and I realized that if I was going to do this, I was going to have to buy a viola.
Yeah.
And they're very expensive. And I just thought my biggest nightmare for solo was that a musician would read it, a viola
And go,
player, and
yes, and
this
would
is
say,
wrong.
oh, that's
Yeah,
never gonna, yeah.
that's never going to happen. But I had played the recorder because a lot of us had played it when we were
Yes.
in school. I could buy a recorder. So I bought a recorder. I did recorder lessons on YouTube and I had access to my choir director is an oboe player, an oboist, but she also plays the recorder and she has a re recorder group who all played at my launch, which was a lot of fun.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, but a recorder that is played well, so stunning.
It can be haunting, can't it? A
Oh,
beautiful sound.
just beautiful, but it has a bad rep because we
Yeah.
all were forced to play it. So I love the idea of this teenage girl like loving the recorder.
Yeah. And it's actually so universal. That's the thing. Like everyone kind of can relate to the recorder in some way or
Yeah,
another.
we were all forced, or the tin whistle, one of the two, you know,
Yeah. And I
depending
think
on
that
where you grew up.
this is going to appeal to like to me anyway, right across generations. Everyone's going to love this. I mean, I adore this. I read it so fast. I read it this morning. It's just got everything in it. It's got like friendship, betrayal and a friendship, you know, heartbreak, you know, the Leaving
Yeah.
Cert, and you know, relationships with parents and siblings and yourself and the whole thing. But it's just so, and it's so light and deep at the same time. It's just absolutely. I'm going to stop talking about it. Let you talk about it
Oh,
because
thank you.
I'm going to ask you to. I'm curious as to know which where you're going to read from for us.
Okay, so it's interesting that you, because I love that you connected so much with the her dad giving her
Yes.
so much advice because so the piece that I'm going to read is Forte. It's her ex-boyfriend asking her how she is the way she is. Actually, and just to say before I read this, I really like David. I think that he's a teenage boy. stupid teenage boy who made stupid decisions, and that's what teenage boys do. And I hope that people don't really hate him at the end. But I think he's kind of, he is what he is, I view him growing into a very good man,
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of empathy for all the characters, and even however flawed they are. I really like that.
Thank you. So this is Forte, loud, strong. Tell me how you do it, he'd asked. One night when I performed and won another trophy, I practice. I'd smile as I went to kiss him. He pushed me back and said, I mean it. And I told him about my father, how he talks to me about my visualizations, my goals, my habits, how he tells me about his visualizations, his goals, his habits. I tell him about my brothers, how he talks to them about their visualizations, their goals, their habits. And I tell him about my mother. Say nothing, do nothing, keep going. You need to want it more. I do want it, he snaps. I know David thinks he wants it. Not enough, I say, and I know he's surprised that I have said something critical of him. It's not enough to go training. It isn't enough to do as much as the rest. Some are naturally faster than you. Some are naturally more flexible than you. Some are naturally more focused than you. You can only beat them two ways. You need to want it more, and you need to do more. And he became stronger, faster, focused, determined. People noticed him wanting it more. No one could believe it except me, because I was the one in his ear, telling him how much he could achieve. As long as he wanted it more.
You've been listening to Gráinne O'Brien, whose debut verse novel for young adults, Solo, is out now with Little Island. See you all next time.